Good morning, everybody. This is Jonathan Perk from the Neurology Department at Downstate. And with me is Dr. Chen Zhao. And we're going to talk about a very interesting topic about the functions of the cerebellum. So, Chen, thank you for coming here. Do you want to say a few words about yourself?
Yes, my name is Chen Zhao. I'm a third-year neurology resident and going to be starting the fourth year soon. So it's really nice to have these podcasts. I listen to the other ones. I think it's great for us to have something to listen to on the way to work or coming home.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we're going to talk about maybe more unusual functions of the cerebellum, but let's remind ourselves of the more known functions of the cerebellum, the motor functions and dysfunctions of the cerebellum.
So the motor functions of the cerebellum, the main motor function of the cerebellum is to modify motor commands of descending pathways. To make movements more adaptive and accurate. So it's an important point that there's no motor commands that are initiated in the cerebellum. The motor commands are initiated in the precentral gyrus and the motor cortex and also the supplemental motor areas nearby. And these motor commands have descending pathways that go through the cerebellum, and the cerebellum modifies these pathways. And the basic motor function of the cerebellum is to make these movements more accurate and also to assist us in maintaining our posture and balance and assist us in coordination of movements and motor learning. So there are many descending pathways that go through the cerebellum. They're very complicated, and there's the corticospinal tracts, the rubrospinal tracts, the vestibulospinal, the reticulospinal. There are many tracks, but the essential take-home point is that the cerebellum modifies these pathways to make our movements more adaptive and accurate. So when there's dysfunction of the cerebellum, then that's when we find signs on the clinical exam of cerebellar dysfunction. So on the cranial nerve exam, we can find nystagmus sometimes, and with a lesion in the flocculo nodular lobe, which is one of the three lobes of the cerebellum. There's the anterior lobe, the posterior lobe, and the flocculo nodular lobe. And typically with a lesion in the flocculo nodular lobe, you might find a downbeating nystagmus. Speech is also affected with cerebellar lesions, and you might hear the term scanning speech used to describe the speech pattern of people with cerebellar lesions. And it's not an aphasia, so it's not an impairment of language. It's more of a dysarthria, and it can be thought of as an ataxia of speech. So instead of pronouncing a word like British the normal way, like British, someone with scanning speech, they might over-enunciate the word and pronounce it British. And it can be thought of as an ataxia of speech, a motor dysfunction. On the motor exam, we can look for decreased tone, hypotonia, and that might manifest itself when you do the patellar knee jerk, and you can find what's known as a pendular knee jerk. So instead of the knee just leg just kicking out once, it kicks out once and it swings back and it keeps swinging for more than four times. And that's a pendular knee jerk and a sign of hypotonia. You can also look for rebound, which is basically an impairment in the ability to check a motor movement. So if you hold the person's hand and ask them to pull on your hand, for a normal person, if you then release your hand, they're able to stop themselves from hitting themselves. They're able to check their motor movements. But someone with a cerebellar lesion, if you ask them to pull on your hand and you pull on their hand and you suddenly release your hand, they might not be able to stop themselves from continuing that movement, and they might actually hit themselves, and that's rebound.
Yeah, it's a good tip to put your hand between you and and between the head of the patient and mm-hmm. his hand, so they actually don't hit themselves mm-hmm. when they have the impairment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and something else you can look for is titubation. And that's basically a severe tremor, either of the whole body or of the head. And if the titubation is really severe, sometimes the patient might not even be able to sit up or stand up. On tests of coordination, we all know what to look for. Sometimes they might have an inattention tremor, and that's basically a tremor whose amplitude increases as the patient is approaching the target. And it tends to be a proximal tremor from the shoulder girdle rather than a distal hand tremor. And it's an endpoint tremor, meaning the tremor gets worse as you approach the target. And the direction of the tremor is perpendicular to the direction of movement. Also, dysmetria is something we look for on exam in the finger to nose. Also, finger to finger and heel to shin. And dysmetria is basically either an undershooting or an overshooting of movement. So instead of pointing to the finger, right at the finger, they might not reach the finger, or they may overshoot and go back to hit reach the finger. Dysdiadochokinesia is something else we can look for on exam, and that just basically means an impairment in rapid alternating movements. And ways to check for that: you can ask the patient to screw and unscrew a light bulb, to pronate and supinate their hands, to tap their toes, keeping their heel on the floor. You can also ask them to do finger tapping, to tap their index finger against their thumb. Although finger tapping can be impaired in other types of lesions as well, such as corticospinal tract lesions, you might have impaired finger tapping, or even a Parkinsonian patient, their finger tapping might be bradykinetic, so it is impaired in other types of pathology as well. And when we get the cerebellar patient up to walk, the gait is impaired as well. If they have severe titubation, again, they might not even be able to sit up or stand. And when they do get up to walk, their gait tends to be wide base and it could be staggering. If they have a cerebellar lesion that involves more the vermis or the midline, then they might have more of a truncoataxia. And if the lesion is more to lateral, in the lateral hemispheres, they may have more limb ataxia of the arms or the legs, and they may fall towards the side of the lesion.
So I think most of us think of the cerebellum as a coordinator of the motor system, but actually the rest of the talk, and I think the really exciting aspect of the cerebellum is the non-motor functions of the cerebellum. So why don't you introduce those functions, and then we can go into them in more detail.
Sure. So the non-motor functions of the cerebellum, we've known about them for a while. There have been case studies as far back as the early 1800s, but it's not something we typically hear a lot about. There's also an observed correlation between cerebellum size and even general IQ. There was a study done that looked at school children's cerebellar volume and their IQ, and they found a correlation, a significant correlation, about 0.29 between cerebellar volume and IQ, and this was after controlling for both age and sex in these school children. And the strength of the correlation is actually almost the same as the correlation between total gray matter volume and IQ. So we have known about non-motor functions of the cerebellum for quite some time. And more recently, Dr. Jeremy Schmaman, a neurologist at Mass General, he came up with the hypothesis called a dysmetria of thought in 1991. And the hypothesis basically is that the cerebellum has a very uniform cytal architecture, and there are many pathways that run through it, both motor pathways and also non-motor from the cortex, diffuse areas of the cortex, as well as the limbic system. And he basically hypothesized that the cerebellum does two the non-motor inputs the same thing it does to the motor inputs, which is that it changes a coarse movements or coarse thoughts or emotions into more accurate ones. And he hypothesized this because he found that there are diffuse connections between the cortex and the cerebellum. And these are all part of the corticopontocerebellar pathway, which basically connects the cortex to the pontine nuclei, down to the cerebellum, and back up to the thalamus, the ventrolateral nucleus, and back up to the cortex. And what's interesting is that it's not only the motor areas of the cortex that are connected to the cerebellum. It's also the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in planning, the posterior parietal cortex, which is involved in visual spatial abilities, and superior temporal cortex, which is involved in complex language, and the parahippocampal regions, which is involved in memory. And all these areas of the cortex have connections to the cerebellum.
So what I find really fascinating is the influence of the cerebellum on specific subtypes of mental function. And one of them that I think we can talk about is the language coordination by the cerebellum. And you talk about metalinguistic deficits. So first of all, what are metalinguistic deficits, and what are they specifically pertaining to the cerebellum?
Sure. So metalinguistic deficits refer to higher level language deficits. And Dr. Schmaman did an interesting study basically called Metalinguistic Deficits and Cerebellum Dysfunction. And he gave patients with cerebellar lesions and control subjects two different tests. One was called the oral sentence production test, which is a test of basic linguistic function, looking at our people able to produce sentences with the correct syntax or grammar, and also a more complicated test called the test of language competence expanded, which looked at higher order linguistic functions or metalinguistics. And that test looked at people's abilities to interpret ambiguous sentences, to make inferences, to recreate sentences, and also looked at their ability with figurative language. And Dr. Schmaman found something interesting, which is that patients with cerebellar lesions, compared to controls, there was no difference in their performance on the test of basic language function, on the oral sentence production test, meaning that patients with cerebellar lesions, they were able to produce sentences with correct syntax, but he found significant differences in performance on the test of language competence expanded test. And patients with cerebellar lesions had lower scores on their ability to produce, to interpret ambiguous sentences and make inferences. Just as an example of the type of error that was made by the cerebellar patients on the TLCE. So the test gives patients a picture of an ambiguous situation of two people standing in what appears to be a bakery. And on top of the picture, they're given three words, fresh, nor, and here. And they're asked to construct a sentence that uses all three of these words that describes the situation that the picture depicts. So the patient with the cerebellar lesion, an example of the type of error they made, they said, "I never thought I would meet you here. Nor did I, because everything seems so fresh here to buy." So we can see that these sentences, they make sense on some level. They have syntax and grammar that we understand, but on a more higher level, the meaning is impaired, and it has poor pragmatic quality. And pragmatics refers to the way language is used in context. So the same words, for example, "good job." If your boss says "good job" to you and you had just succeeded in a difficult project, that means one thing. But let's say you had just failed at a project and your boss says, good job, he probably means it in a sarcastic way, and that has a different pragmatic meaning. So it's in these higher order levels that patients with cerebellar lesions, they have deficits.
So they won't be able to either produce it or understand that
right.
sarcasm.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just to make sure we're on the same page, they definitely do not have aphasia, right? When you check for naming, repetition, all the usual stuff that we check for aphasia, they won't have any impairment in those.
Exactly, exactly. So patients with cerebellar lesions, their deficits are more higher level, and it's not a classic aphasia, and there's no deficits in, you know, reading, writing, those basic tests of impairment of language.
What I find fascinating is the role of the cerebellum in music appreciation. And actually, I have to say that thinking about it, it's not all that surprising, thinking about what the cerebellum does. So tell us more about that.
So there was an interesting study that used transcranial magnetic stimulation to basically target the right cerebellum and suppress it and essentially create a virtual lesion by temporarily suppressing the function of that region. And they basically gave these participants, there were 14 of them, transcranial magnetic stimulation or a sham treatment with sham TMS. And after a session of the treatment, they gave them a task to discriminate between tones of different pitches or a task where they discriminate between tones with the same frequency but different timbre. So it's the same tone but played by a flute versus a violin. And they found that basically transcranial magnetic stimulation directed at the right cerebellum affected the ability to discriminate pitch, but it did not affect the ability to discriminate timbre. So that was one small study that looked at the cerebellum's role in pitch and timbre. And there was another small study, it's a German study, that looked at how cerebellar lesions affect the ability to assess rhythm of music, meter of music, the ability to compare melodies, two melodies, to see whether they're identical melodies or different, and also to assess the emotional content of music, discriminate pitch, and recognize familiar German melodies. And they use different German melodies that were familiar to most German citizens, like Für Jacques, the folk song, Christmas Carols, Air by Bach, Yesterday by the Beatles. And that study was interesting, and it basically found that patients with cerebellar lesions, they have deficits in some types of musical abilities, such as the ability to compare different melodies and recognize that they're the same melody. They had deficits in a meter, and they had deficits in recognizing the emotional content of music. So they more often thought music was happier when they weren't meant to be happy, and they also did not recognize music that was supposed to express anger. So that's something that was interesting.
So it's again kind of a meta, kind of an extra analysis step, that, you know, connecting the emotion, and it's truly fascinating. And I think even more fascinating is the role of the cerebellum in us as part of a social system. So can you talk about that?
Right. So so the cerebellum's role in social cognition. There was actually a study that looked at emotion attribution. And what emotion attribution is, it's our ability to understand others' emotions. And it can be measured through a test called Reading the Mind and the Eyes test, which is basically a test of different people's faces, specifically of the eyes. You know, the eyes can express many different emotions. It can express worry, happiness, Patients are given 36 different pictures of just the eyes, and these pictures are intended to convey a certain type of emotion. Normal people are able to identify the correct emotion in about 30 of these pictures, but patients with autism have an impairment in this ability. They look at the face or the picture of the eyes that are intended to represent worry, but they don't see the emotion. They misidentify the emotion perhaps as happiness instead of worry. So they have an impairment in their ability to perceive emotions through these facial expressions. And that's emotion attribution. So the study gave patients this test to measure emotion attribution and also gave them a questionnaire called the Cerebellar Neuropsychiatric Rating Scale, which is basically a self-assessment of social skills and autism spectrum type of behaviors. And the authors found that there was a significant correlation between emotion attribution impairment as measured on the Reading the Mind and the Eyes test and this test, the CNRS test, which is a self-assessment in social skills and autism spectrum disorders. And it basically suggests that there is a link between autism spectrum types of behaviors and emotion attribution impairment. That makes sense in terms of what we know about the connections between the cerebellum and limbic areas of the brain.
So I guess also we can focus on the effects of the cerebellum on the inner world of our mood and emotions. There looks like the cerebellum plays a role there as well.
Yes, and there's some suggestion that when there's cerebellar dysfunction, patients might have depression, they might have apathy, they might have inappropriate emotional responses, and that's something we don't necessarily always pay attention to when someone has a cerebellar stroke or they have other pathology in the cerebellum, but that is something that can happen after damage to the cerebellum.
And is that what you refer to as cerebellar cognitive affect syndrome?
Yes, and that was a term coined by Dr. Schmaman and in the 1990s, and he used it to describe a constellation of symptoms that he found consistently with patients who had cerebellar lesions. And these patients, basically, they had multitasking difficulties, they had working memory problems, they had impairment in their spatial skills, they also had emotional impairment. They had inappropriate emotional responses. They were apathetic. They were inappropriately aggressive. Sometimes they were depressed. And he found that consistently with lesions in the posterior cerebellum. With the anterior cerebellum, when there's lesions in that area, that tended to cause more motor dysfunction. But he found that patients with lesions in the posterior cerebellum, they tended to have more cognitive or emotional impairments. And he called this constellation of impairments the cerebellar cognitive affective syndrome.
So with all those multiple problems and directions, what can be done? Is there anything that we can do to help those patients?
I think just important for us as clinicians is to be aware that these impairments can occur after damage to the cerebellum, whether it's from a stroke, whether it's from an acquired toxicity like alcohol. The first step is to be aware that there's an organic cause for this dysfunction. We can also advise them of coping strategies such as keeping a journal and avoiding multitasking. We can send them for formal neuropsychological evaluation to better distinguish between the specific type of cognitive impairment they have. And we can treat psychiatric symptoms symptomatically if they're depressed or they have other emotional impairments, we can recognize that and refer them to psychiatrists as need be.
So this is really fascinating. So, Chen, so what are some of the take-home messages that you would like our listeners to put in their toolbox under their belt?
I think a take-home message is that cerebellar dysfunction can produce significant and under-recognized deficits in cognition, in emotion, and in language, and specifically lesions in the posterior parts of the cerebellum or the vermis in adults. They can cause a constellation of symptoms, both in terms of cognitive impairment and emotional impairment. That's called the cerebellar cognitive affective syndrome, coined by Dr. Schmamm in the 1990s. And I think the most important thing is just to be aware that these deficits can occur after damage to the cerebellum, to refer patients for further neuropsychological testing as needed, to psychiatrists as needed.
That's superb. So, Chen, thank you very much. And I should have mentioned that Chen Zhao is going to, after she completes her residency, to do a fellowship in dementia in Colombia. I think very suitable, and this is really exciting stuff, and really the front line. So thank you very much, Chen. And again, this is Jonathan Perk from SUNY Downstate Neurology Department. And we'll see you in the next podcast.